something that distinguishes the Seder of Vayakhel from the Seder of Truma, which is almost a repeat. However, the Gemara says the following. We'll start with the Gemara in Brachos, and then we'll see if there's some other differences, and we'll try to explain all of them in the same way. The Gemara says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu the mitzvah of building the Mishkan, he did it in the following order. He told him first, this is what, make a Mishkan, the plant, the structure of the Mishkan, and then make Aron and the rest of the Kelim. When Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain and he told Bezalel what to do, so he told him first to make the Aron and the Kelim, and then to build the Mishkan. And Bezalel said, that can't be. That's not the way of the world. A person doesn't first bring his furniture and then build a house around it. But first you build a house and then you put in the furniture. Because if I build the furniture first, where am I going to put it? Moshe Rabbeinu said, you were very astute and you understood that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me, in fact, to make the Mishkan first and then the Kelim, not like I told you. And that's why he was called Bezalel. Because Bezalel Kel Hayisa V'yadata, you were in the shadow of God and you knew. Two questions, which obviously I'm not the first one to ask. Hold on. After I finish, you can ask me if you want. Maybe I'll cover what you want to ask. The first question is, how did Moshe Rabbeinu switch around what God told him? If God, in fact, told Moshe Rabbeinu to first build the Mishkan and then the Kelim, then how did Moshe Rabbeinu tell Bezalel the opposite? And for whatever reason he did that, right, to test him, to trick him, whatever it was, right, why did Moshe Rabbeinu say that Bezalel was wise and understood what the Rebbe really said, that he was Bezalel Kel, he was in the shadow of God? Usually, shadow is a euphemism of doubt, not clarity. Sunlight, right, Borer Kashemesh, or Silo Shalsofik, right, the shadow of a doubt, right, or clear as the day, clear as sunlight. So if you want to say that Bezalel was clear, you should have said his name should have been Orkel, not Bezalel, not Bezalel, but Orkel. So why is Bezalel? Why is Bezalel? Why the shadow? Ah, Uri. Bezalel ben Uri, I hear. Okay. Yeah. So, but Bezalel? Okay, maybe there are other answers, but again, Bezalel is usually connected to doubt. Shadow of a doubt. Bezalel, Silo Shel Sofek, is a Hebrew Chazal use that. Okay, in any case, in order to understand this, I'm going to start with something else that I think years ago we spoke about here, but the faces have changed since then. So most of you at least weren't here then. And that's the following. Chazal learned from the fact that the Aron was inlaid with gold and outlaid with gold that a Talmud Chacham should be Tocho Kibarim. His inside should be like the outside. Okay? Now, on the surface, that seems difficult because it should really say that the outside should be like the inside. Right? Talmud Chacham, the Iker is the inside. Right? That's what you want to do. And then you should project outwardly how what you are on the inside. But it seems like the outside is the main thing, and the inside should be like the outside. First you start with the outside, and then you make the inside become like the outside. The truth is, that's the way that it is. Right? The emotions create emotions. You can't get your neshama moving. You can't get tremendous spiritual inner levels without going through the motions first. The Chinuch says it's the whole idea of mitzvah spaisil. A person is affected by his pe'ulos, by what he does, what he externally wears, what he says on the outside. All the mitzvahs are to engender within a person tremendously inner ideas, but it has to start on the outside. That's the way the world is. You don't reach very high levels just like this. You have to get into them very slowly and in an external way, and the externals bring to the internal. I once had a woman who was a balas tshuva. She was a balas, a real balas tshuva. She was born to a frum family, but a more modern Orthodox family. And the way that she dressed was not exactly halachic. And she came a long way, and in Shabbos she became more machmer, and in Kashrus she became more machmer, and she really was going very, very fine in becoming much more a medakdekis in mitzvahs. So at some point I felt that she's ready to start dressing a little bit different than she does, to be more halachic. So I said to her, I think that, you know, it would be a good idea if you started to be makbid in this kind of dress. So she said, Rabbi, I'll tell you the truth. I don't feel on the inside yet that I'm really holding by that. And I wouldn't want to put on a show as if I'm a Rebbetzin when inside I don't feel like that's the way I am. I said, you know what that could be compared to? The following. Somebody comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, I really don't feel happy inside. So if I get up and dance, I'm going to be a hypocrite. I'm going to look like I'm happy, and I'm really not. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy, and as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. The guy will sit there for Bishop. Right? How do you get happy? You dance. It's not hypocrisy. That's how you make yourself happy. You go through the motions, and that engenders inner feelings. Same thing, right? If you continually dress in an immodest way, you're never going to feel modest. But if you start dressing modestly and you want to feel like that, that will engender your feeling like you're supposed to feel. And that's the whole Torah, like that. Going through the motions to reach the emotions. Hypocrisy is where you don't want to reach that inner feeling. You just want to put on a show. That's a hypocrite. But somebody who wants to get to that inner feeling, the way to do it is by going through the motions. So that is what Chazal are telling us, that a Talmud Chacham has to be Tocho Kibaro. You start with the outside, and then you get to the inside. There's only one problem. That's the way that Chazal describes it. That's not the way the Torah describes it. The Torah says, how did they coat the Aron with gold, inside and out? It says, should I put them surely, and I thought this by heart. Last week in my drasha in the shul, I spoke about not quoting Divrei Torah v'chsav bal peh. Last week said, "Ksav lechos advarim, yalpi advarim leil." Even though there are many reasons why this would be mutter, but not all of them apply. Yeah? Torah says like this: make an aron, the yosisa aron atzei shitim. Vitzipisa oso zahar tahar, mi bayis umichutz titzapet. So which one is mentioned first? Inside. No, mi bayis. Bayis means inside. Michutz is outside. So mi bayis umichutz titzapet. So why did the rabbis describe the Talmud Chacham as being toko kibaro, with all the explanation we gave of why the outside comes first, when the Torah Taka said that first you inlay the aron with gold, and then only after that you do the outside? So I want to say that the pasuk really means the following: Vitzipisa oso zahav tahar. You should outlay it with gold. That was the only pasuk. It says you take an aron, which is wood, and you cover it with gold. On which side would you put the gold? The inside or the outside? The outside. That's like all the other cavemen. All the cavemen had gold on the outside, and that's what it said. Period. Now it says, Mibayis, inside, Bachot, and outside. So really there were three coverings of gold. There was one first on the outside. That was what it says, in Sipiso, Sozahav, Tahar. Then there was one on the inside, so the inside followed the outside. And then again, there was one on the outside. Outside, inside, outside. That's very nice, but how does it fit with actuality? It's very nice. How did they make the Aron outlaid and inlaid with gold? Rashi said, there are three boxes. There was a small gold box, which fit into a medium-sized wooden box, which the wooden box filled in fit into a larger-sized gold box. So the large gold box covered the aron on the outside. The small gold box covered on the inside. There's only one thing missing. So what did they do? First, they put the wooden box inside the outside gold box. So they covered it with gold on the outside. Then they put the little gold box inside the wooden box. Now it's on the inside. Outside, inside. What's left? The board. If you look from the top, there was a sandwich. You saw gold, wood, and gold. Right? Now what did they have to do? Take more gold and cover the top. So the whole aron was covered in gold. That's on the outside. So what did they do? They did first the outside, then the inside, and then again the outside. That's exactly what the Torah says. Piso, Soza, Tar, outside. Nibayas, inside. Bachut, again, outside. The living. Right? The top. So that's the order. All right, so what do we learn from that? What we learn from that is the following. That after you have, what happens, let's go back to simple Torah. Okay, you want to get happy. You want to feel happy with the Torah. So you have to go through the motions. You have to dance. Okay, now, after you dance for a while, you really feel on the inside happy. What should you do now? Sit down and stop dancing? Now you don't need the outside anymore. Now you have the inside. Finish. No. You continue dancing. Because there are two purposes for external action. One is to act as an incentive to bring about internal feelings. The second purpose is to express those internal feelings in a concrete way. There is a Ramban in his Perush on Shir HaShirim who says the following: Matoiru umatooru es ho'ava ad shetechpas. And he explains it the following way. It sounds almost like a Hasidish word, but it's Ramban. He says, if you have and you are aroused to high spiritual feelings, Toiru v'tisoreru, do not leave it floating in the air in the abstract. Ad shetechpats, until you put it into some kind of cheder. Express those ethereal, abstract feelings in a very concrete, physical way. So there are three stages. The first stage is that you need to go through the external motions to arouse internal feelings. And once you have the internal feelings, you have to then express them externally so they have a misgeret, they have a framework, and they become much more concrete. Just one thing along those lines, the whole long arichos, but it's not what we're talking about, just the concept I want to bring to you. There's a Ramosha Cordoviro says that the neshamas in Gan Eden are waiting for Tchias HaMeisim, like we are waiting for Mashiach. Mashiach's time will be the ultimate in Shmiras HaMitzvahs for the living, and Tchias HaMeisim will be a more potent time of Shmiras HaMitzvahs for the dead. You would think that these people are in spiritual realm, and they're on a higher level than when they'll come back to the body. So the Ramak says, no. Keeping mitzvahs in a physical way is on a higher plane than keeping them just spiritual. When they're only on a spiritual plane, they're not as potent as when they're spiritual and physical together. So there's an idea of not only doing the physical to get to the spiritual, but there's also an idea of doing the spiritual through the physical afterwards, after you get to the spiritual, to give the spiritual more potency, something more concrete. In any case, now let's see with the Tzalim. What was the purpose of the Mishkan? Okay? Why did God want us to build a physical plant, the Mishkan? So, before the Chet HaEgel, okay, and the Mishkan was already commanded before the Jewish people sinned by the Egel. Moshe Rabbeinu was up on Har Sinai. Before the 40 days were up, Moshe Rabbeinu already had heard the mitzvah of the Mishkan, and it was described to him how the Mishkan should be built. However, he didn't actually give it over to the Jewish people until after the sin of the golden calf. After he came down from the mountain, he broke the luchos. He went for 80 days trying to be mechaper on Klal Yisrael, which lasted until Yom Kippur. And it was only the day after Yom Kippur that he commanded the Jewish people about the Mishkan, and they started actually building it. And that was after the Chet HaEgel. Now, before the Chet HaEgel, the Torah says very clearly the following. The Sfarno says it very clearly, that's what it means. B'chol mokom asher azkir eshmi avo eilecha uveirachtiach. Before the Chet HaEgel, there was no need for any specific place in the world for Jews to have to come and be inspired to feel God's presence. You could feel God's presence equally everywhere in the world. There was no need for a specific geographic place to get to that feeling. The inner feeling could come anywhere. You didn't need a Mishkan to generate those inner feelings. The inner feelings which could be had anywhere. So therefore, based on this, the purpose of the Mishkan was not to inspire a person that he should feel God's presence, that he should feel lofty spiritual ideas, because he could do that anyway. So then what was the purpose of the Mishkan? The purpose of the Mishkan was the opposite, to take those lofty spiritual ideas, which he could get anywhere, and come and use the physical kalim, the physical utensils of the Mishkan, and the Mishkan itself being a kli, right, to use to express those high spiritual feelings. You didn't need the Mishkan to generate the feelings, but you needed the Mishkan on the other end. Like we said, whenever you have high spiritual feelings, you should try to express them in concrete, physical ways. So the purpose of the Mishkan was the people should come with their high spiritual feelings and be able to use the Mishkan as an expression of these feelings in a concrete way. What? Okay, how? Okay, I'll explain what it means. Let's take the Kalim and the Mishkan. You come to the Mishkan and you would, you had a very high feeling of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, and you came to the Mishkan and you brought sacrifices, right, that express your love and fear of God. Okay? That was one thing, that's using the Mizbeach. Then the Shulchan, okay, which had the bread on it, which was a influence of Parnassah in Klal Yisrael, right, was a result of not just the Kohanim who put the bread on the table, but every Jew who had very, very fine thoughts of Bitachon, right, would be able to express those thoughts of Bitachon through the Kohen who would do the Avodah in the Mishkan. It could be also, thinking about it now, it wasn't Kohanim who would have to do it. It was only the Kohanim, it was only after the Chet HaEgel. Every Jew, right, the Ramban says, it was priority to the firstborn, but every Jewish firstborn could be a Kohen. And the Ramban says it wasn't only firstborn, they only had priority. Every Jew could have been a Kohen. So every Jew could have come into the temple and done these specific things that represented all these feelings. The Shulchan represented Bitachon, and the Ketores on the golden altar represented a different concept. And by doing the Avodah and having a share in it, right? Even if it was only a mental share, it helped express those feelings in a physical way. So if the Kohanim were doing it, they were doing it as the agents of the Jewish people who had these tremendous feelings, and it was expressed by the Kohanim in this physical avoda. But what I'm saying is, if there hadn't been a Chet HaEgel, all the Jews would have been able to come and at some point do the avoda or do it through an agent. So that was the purpose of the Mishkan before the Chet HaEgel. After the Chet HaEgel, the Jewish people needed a place to generate those feelings. They weren't on the level anymore that any place in the world. They showed that they needed some kind of intermediary, some kind of physical thing to concentrate their emotions to. That's what they needed in Egypt. So as a kapara for that, the Rabban Shem said, I'll give you a place that will help you to generate these feelings. And once you generate the feelings, now you can use the kelim, the various vessels of the Mishkan, to express those feelings. But you need the Mishkan first to generate the feelings before you can express them. You need the first stage. That was missing. The need for the first stage didn't exist before the Chet HaEgel, only after. If that's the case, then when God told Moshe Rabbeinu, I want you to build a Mishkan, okay, he actually told him to build first the Mishkan and then the Kelim. Why? Because God knew there was going to be a sin of the golden calf. The Jewish people would not be on the level anymore where they'd be able to generate those feelings everywhere. They would need the Mishkan to help them generate these feelings of awareness of God and love of God and fear of God in a Mishkan. And then they would use the Kelim, the vessels, to express it. Okay? But which came first? First the Mishkan. First the structure to generate the feelings. Then the Kelim. Okay? But if God had told Moshe Rabbeinu that openly, okay, then Moshe would have said, what's going on? The Jewish people, when I left them, were on a level that they could get these feelings anywhere. Why didn't a Mishkan build? Why are you building a Mishkan to generate feelings that they have anyway? What would Moshe Rabbeinu have sensed? Something's going to happen. There's going to be a sin. These people are going to fall from that level. They're going to need a Mishkan to generate the feelings, not just as a place to express them. And that can't be. Because even though God's foreknowledge of the sin doesn't affect free will, because God's knowledge is not like our knowledge, and God can know something and it doesn't necessarily affect a person's free choice, but if Moshe Rabbeinu would have known, right, then that would have affected free choice. Moshe would have known they're going to sin. Then a human being knowing ahead of time would have affected their free choice. So similar to what the Meshech Chachma says by Rabbi Akiva. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand what Rabbi Akiva was darshaning. And he explains why, because Rabbi Akiva was darshaning all the halachas they needed in Golas not to mix with the Goyim. Had Moshe Rabbeinu understood it, it would have preempted the fact that there had to be a Golas like that. And therefore he couldn't understand what Rabbi Akiva was saying, because it would have affected their free choice if he would have understood. Similar to that, what we're saying now. Therefore, God said to Moshe Rabbeinu in an obscure way that he would think that first come the Kelim and then the Mishkan, meaning first you have the feelings. Now use the Kelim to express it in a physical way, and with that you create a new structure of higher feelings by expressing them in a concrete way. So what was the order that Moshe Rabbeinu understood? Wrongly, but God wanted him to understand it wrongly, because he had to understand it right, it would have preempted the sin of the golden calf. So God told him in an obscure way, in a way that sounded, first I want the Kelim and then the Mishkan. So when he told it over to Bezalel, he told it in the obscure way that he got it, to hide from him the real order. But Bezalel understood the tzel, the obscure thing. The tzel kel, you understood that God told it to me in an obscure way, because now it's after the sin of the golden calf. When he gave it over to Bezalel, it was after the sin of the golden calf. Bezalel said, now the way of the world is different, right? Things have changed. I can't, if I don't build the Mishkan first, what are you going to use these kelim for? First you have to need the structure to generate the feeling. You're not going to come with the feelings to use the kelim. So therefore, the tzala was the tzel kel. He understood the the shadow that God cast over over Moshe Rabbeinu in telling him in an obscure way, and knowing that that wasn't really what he meant, but he couldn't tell it to that him in the beginning because it would have preempted the sin of the golden calf. But after the sin of the golden calf, the child understood right away. That's not what God meant. He really meant to tell you the other way, because now the way of the world is that you need first to generate the feelings, then to express them. But God obscured it. He put you into a shade. So Moshe said, you understood the shade of God that he put me, and he didn't want me to understand till now. You're right. That's not good. Now looking back, that's really what the Rebbe Shlom meant, but he didn't want me to understand that till now. Okay, that answer that explains that. With that, I want to explain another thing, the difference. This Bemis the Meshech Chochma says for a different reason, but it fits in beautifully with what we're saying. In Parshas Kisisa, okay, where Moshe is basically given the command, there the Torah mentions Shabbos after the Mishkan. First it mentions the Mishkan, then Shabbos. In this coming week's Sedra, the Torah mentions Shabbos and then the Mishkan. Now, what do we learn from this coming week's Sedra, another mitzvah? That the building of the Mishkan does not take precedence over Shabbos. But Shabbos takes precedence over the Mishkan. How do I know that? Because the Shabbos precedes the Mishkan. Before the command of the Mishkan comes Shabbos. Shabbos comes first. Says the Meshech Chochma, if that's the case, then in Kisisa, where Shabbos comes last, it would seem to imply that you could build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Mishkan comes first. So which is it? Here it seems like the Mishkan is what's it called secondary Shabbos. And there it seems like the Mishkan is before Shabbos, which means you couldn't build it on Shabbos. So I'm going to say what he says, but adapt it to what it fits over here. Basically, we know that the Karbanos in the Mishkan, you're allowed to do on Shabbos. You're allowed to make the Lechem Aponim, the parts that have to be done on Shabbos on Shabbos. You light the menorah on Shabbos. Okay? Can't get more of a chil Shabbos than that, lighting a menorah. Light the menorah on Shabbos. All these things take precedence over Shabbos. So why can't you build the Mishkan on Shabbos? So basically, I think what he says is the following, and this is what he says, it fits in beautifully. If not, then we're safe. Why can't you build a Mishkan on Shabbos? Because Shabbos brings the Shekhinah, it brings God's presence into the world. Shabbos itself is God's presence is here. Right? We receive God's presence as we receive a Malka, a guest. Shabbos is the Bas Sug of Klal Yisrael. It's bringing God's presence into the world. Building a Mishkan is to bring God's presence into the world. It would be a slight to Shabbos if you built the Mishkan on Shabbos. Why do you need to build a Mishkan to bring God's presence into the world? Shabbos brings God's presence into the world. It's like not wearing tefillin on Shabbos. Tefillin is an oath that you have a connection to God, so is Shabbos. If you wear tefillin, it's an affront to Shabbos. What do you need the tefillin for? Shabbos is enough of an oath. Same idea. What? Oh, 1 second. But the avoda is not bringing God's presence into the world. It's serving God's presence. That doesn't contradict Shabbos. I can serve God's presence on Shabbos too. But to bring God's presence, I don't need that. Shabbos does that. Why do I have to duplicate by building a Mishkan on Shabbos when Shabbos itself brings God's presence into the world? So building a Mishkan is an affront to the idea of Shabbos. But doing the Avodah in the Mishkan is serving the Shekhinah. That has nothing to contradict Shabbos. You can serve the Shekhinah on Shabbos, right? So that doesn't have an affront to Shabbos, right? But bringing the Shekhinah by building the Mishkan, that contradicts the concept of Shabbos. It's superfluous. It's redundant. Avodah is not redundant to Shabbos, but building a Mishkan is redundant to Shabbos. That's a good way of describing it. Okay? Now, okay, well, he says, perfect. Before the Chet HaEgel, the purpose of the Mishkan was not to bring God's presence. God's presence is everywhere. It was to serve God's presence. Even the building of the Mishkan was a surface to God's presence. It wasn't to create a place where God's presence could be felt. First, he used the Kelim, and that created a new, higher level of God's presence. That doesn't, not in front of Shabbos, not redundant to Shabbos. So before the Chet HaEgel and Kisisa, where God gave the command to Moshe Rabbeinu when he made the Kalim before the Mishkan, as if that would have been, had it not been for the Chet HaEgel, then the Mishkan could be built on Shabbat. It's only after, in Vayakel, after the Chet HaEgel, where Moshe actually told Bezalel, and Bezalel said, no, now it has to be the other order. First you need the Mishkan and then the Kalim. And the purpose of the Mishkan is to create Shechinah. Now it can't be built on Shabbos anymore, because now it's in front of Shabbos. Now it accomplishes the same thing that Shabbos does. So it's a result. And it's first. Yeah, but there we learn it not from the order. There we learn it from Ani Hashem. Kulchem chayotim chlodim. Right? So even though you're responsible, there the idea is different. Even though you're responsible to honor your parents, but your parents are responsible to honor me. And therefore, kulchem chayotim chlodim. So there the limud is a different limud. It's not because of the order. I'll tell you an interesting story and something else about the Mishkan. I had a girl in my kehila who was a balas tshuva, and as balas tshuva are sometimes, especially recent balas tshuva, green balas tshuva, they like to be machmer in everything. Okay, they don't know any gray shades of anything. It's black and white, and they look at it black. Which is very good, which is necessary. The growth of a person, and then they can, you know, first you have to be extreme, and then you can mellow out. Okay, you should have seen me when I was young. In any case, so one of my sons reminds me of what I used to be like. In Miami at the time, we had the glatt kosher meat that was brought in from out of town. There was no shechita in Miami because there was no grass, there was no grazing places for cattle, and meat wasn't produced in Miami, only dairy. But what's it called? Meat was brought in from Denver, I think. And glatt kosher, good hechsher. But there were some people in the kehila that wanted only chassidish shechita. The source that we had wasn't chassidish shechita. So chassidish has nothing to do with the shechita, has to do with the shoftim. A shofet doesn't have a beard. He may be a tzaddik gomer, but if he doesn't have a beard, can't be Hasidic Shechita. So they wanted some Hidurim that were only Hasidic Shechita, and however, there weren't enough people in the community to warrant bringing that meat into the butcher shop. Right? It was too expensive. So what they arranged was that they would bring this meat in, like every 3 months, in a wholesale way. Anybody who wanted it would have to get a 4/4 of an animal at a time, right? Get a special freezer to keep it in, right, and keep it 3 months at a time, 4 months at a time, and then another 4 months. And the price of the meat was about double the price of the regular meat. Anybody who wanted it wanted to be mahadur had to pay for the heder, and you had to go also to a distribution place where they would cut this up, right, which was a schlach place about 30 miles out of the city. So one day, the mother of this girl was living with her mother, she didn't have a father, and her mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Mom is zero, but she was a very good mother. She did anything this girl wanted. This girl came home, she said, I need this, I need that, whatever you need. But the mother really didn't understand, and one day the mother comes into my office, she says, Rabbi, I really don't understand you. Aren't you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. Then why don't you eat kosher? I said, okay, here, what's coming down? I said, okay, sit down. Let me hear the story. She says, my daughter says that she cannot buy meat in the butcher shop that you supervise and that you eat from. Right? She has to get kosher meat. And kosher meat, she said, you have to travel 30 miles out of town to pick up once every 4 months, spend double the price, and I have to buy a freezer to put it in. Now, why don't you eat kosher? So I called the girl in, and I said to her, I want to tell you a dasakeinani paliatosis. Pasha is true. Das Kenim says the following. The Torah says that the Aron was inlaid with gold and outlaid with gold. It was a box of wood, basically, with a thin layer of gold on the inside and a thin layer of gold on the outside. And that teaches us that a Talmud Chacham should be inside and outside gold. Okay? So it says the Das Kenim, wouldn't it have been better if the Aron was solid gold? Forget about the wood. Take a solid gold Aron. Now that's a real Talmud Chacham. Solid gold. not some wood in the middle, right? Because it's desiccated, because it was solid gold, but those dimensions, that's what it was ready to carry. I, the Aron, carried the people who carried it, and so can Allah make. That's what he says. You don't rely on miracles, it had to be able to be carried naturally, and if it had been solid gold, it would have been too heavy to carry. I say, no, we learn from this, but if you want to be solid gold, but because of that, you're going to be too heavy to be carried. If you want to travel 30 miles to pick up this meat, and you want to make the extra expense, and you want to buy the freezer, that's a great hinder, you can be solid gold. But if being solid gold is having your mother drive 30 miles, and her spending the double money, and her buying the freezer, then if you're going to be too heavy to be carried by somebody else, then maybe you shouldn't be solid gold. We're not talking about halachas, we're talking about hidurim. Right? A hither that you can do, you want to be mahadar and get up and say tikkun chatzos every night. But if you wake up your whole family and they're not going to get a decent night's sleep because you want to be mahadar and say tikkun chatzos, maybe you should say tikkun chatzos, chatzos hayom, not chatzos halayim. Or maybe you should go somewhere else to say it, right? And not in the middle of the living room, right, where you're wailing and keeping everybody up. So when it comes to being solid gold, if it means that you're going to be too heavy to carry by somebody else has to carry your solid gold. Now don't be solid gold. There'll be a little wood inside. Next. Something interesting about the Big Day Kahuna, since they're also mentioned by Yaakov and Kude. It says that there were two kaparas for Rosh Hashanah. One was the Me'il, which had bells and pomegranates and made a lot of noise. The Nishma Kol Bevor Lakodesh, and Yavol Dover Shebekol, the Echaper Al Dover Shebekol, something that makes noise, should be Mechaper on a sin that comes from noise. And then there was another Kapara for Lashon Hara, the Ketores, the incense, also was Mechaper for Lashon Hara. So the Gemara asks, why do you need two Kaparas for Lashon Hara? The Ketores and the Me'il. Says the Gemara, one of them was for Lashon Hara Shebechashai, silent Lashon Hara, and the other was Lashon Hara should be called vocal Lashon Hara. Now normally, you understand that to mean, I think everybody understands that to mean, simply, there's Lashon Hara that you say publicly, the call, and there's Lashon Hara you whisper and you say secretly. So one is for the secret Lashon Hara, one's for the vocal Lashon Hara. That can't be. Because where do we learn that the Ketores is Mechapra Lashon Hara? When the Jewish people said, Atem Hamitim Esam Hashem, after Korach died and all his entourage, so the Jewish people accused Moshe and Aaron of killing Korach and his entourage. You're the ones who caused it. And that's when the Magepa came, and that's when the Ketores stopped them. Ketores, that was open Lashon Hara. They came and they said, Atem Hamitim Esam Hashem. They didn't say it in whispers. They Lachoras, as the Torah says, they came and said it. So, and that's Mechapra on Lashon Hara Shebechashoy. So what does it mean? So I was thinking, perhaps maybe it means like this. I have a different shot, different time, but I have a different idea. There's two kinds of Lashon Hara. There's one kind of Lashon Hara which you're not allowed to say at all. You have to keep quiet. That is the alternative. Keep quiet, don't say anything, because the thing is Lashon Hara. If you say it, it's Lashon Hara. That kind of Lashon Hara is like Atem Amiti, speaking Lashon Hara, Moshe and Aaron, they killed Korach. That's Lashon Hara, that none of it can be said. It's keep quiet. Okay, that's the alternative. Then there's a different kind of Lashon Hara. That's called Lashon Hara Shebekol. Lashon Hara that you do have to say something. But the way you say it can either make it Lashon Hara or make it okay or a mitzvah. For instance, Lito Ellis, right? Somebody says to me, what do you know about so-and-so? Right? I am interested in going into business with him. And I know the guy is a crook. I know it for sure. No shyness, right? I've seen him robbing people, cheating people, whatever, personally, okay? And you want to go into business and he'll cheat the life out of you. So I can't say, ooh, Lashon Hara, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. So I say, oh, I guess he's a nice guy. Right? Or somebody comes to me and says, what do you know about so-and-so? I'm interested in making a shidduch with him, with this person. Right? Do you know anything about him? And I know he's a wife killer. Right, he's murdered 7 wives before. So, oh no, Lashon Hara, I don't want to say about the guy. No, why don't you be the 8th? The halacha is that I have to say, but I have to say it only if it's a toelis to the person who needs to know. can't tell everybody in the world about it, if they don't even know, right? I can't exaggerate. I can't say he killed 14 wives, he only killed 7, right? Can't exaggerate. And I can't do it with malice. I have to do it purely because I want to help the person who's asking me and warn them of a danger that I know exists, or any other kind of thing. That's called the toelis. So there, I have to say it, but the way I say it makes a difference. That's called Lashon Hara Shebekol. It's Lashon Hara you have to say, but it becomes Lashon Hara if you don't say it the proper way. Now, on the Me'il, very interesting, the Me'il had a Sofa. It had an opening where the head went, and it had a hem, seam, whatever, what? Whatever. A seam that made it, you couldn't tear it. Okay, what does that tell me? The Me'il represented Lashon Hara, we have to open your mouth. It has a mouth, but it also has lips around that can't be torn. There's a certain framework within which you can open your mouth, and not more than that. So the Me'il, according to what I'm saying, represents this Lashon Hara Shebekol, had to have a Sofa around which couldn't be torn, meaning when you open your mouth and you say the thing that if you don't say it properly will be Lashon Hara, but you have to say it, make sure that you say it within the framework and don't go out of that framework, don't tear the Sofa. Another thing is the Eifod and the Choshen, another mitzvah, that the Eifod and the Choshen had to be connected. And you weren't allowed, lo yizach ha-choshen me'al ha-eifod. The choshen could not be moved off the eifod. They had to constantly be connected together. So here, I was thinking, the rabbis say that the eifod was a kapara for avodah zarah, for bad belief, for emunas, roles, right, for false ideologies. And the choshen was a kapara for ivus hadin, for what's it called, for civil law, okay? Dinor l'chaveira, civil law between man and man. And I was thinking, what's the meaning that you can't separate the choshen from the eifod? Two things. One is that you can't separate civil law from emunah, from belief in God. You can't go to a secular court with your civil cases. You have to go to a Jewish court, because the same God that gave Shabbos gave civil law. They come from the same place. Civil law is not just something man-made that's for the sake of society, which secular courts can judge. It's as religious law as Shabbos and anything else. And you wouldn't go to a secular court to tell you Hilchas Shabbos. You can't go to a secular court to tell you Hilchas Dinim either. So you can't separate the Choshen and the Eifod, the Emunah, from the civil law. The opposite is also true. You can't separate the emunah from civil law either. Meaning, you can't just be a frum person when it comes to Bein Adam L'Malchut. But when it comes to Bein Adam L'Chaveira, you're a cheat and a liar and you're not a good person. You can't separate your daily civil, social interactions from your emunah. They have to go together. You can't be a person who's only Bein Adam L'Malchut, and you can't be a person who's Bein Adam L'Chaveira separate from Bein Adam L'Malchut. The Bein Adam L'Malchut and Bein Adam L'Chaveira have to be one integral thing that can't be separated one from the other. I was thinking of another thing that the Eifod and the Choshen represent, basically, according to this. When it comes to Emunah, we're all equal, all united. That's why the Eifod had stones on it with six names of Shvatim here and six names over here, and what's it called, and the Kohen in the middle. You know what that reminds me of? Har Grizim and Har Eifod. He had six Shvatim on one mountain, six Shvatim on the other mountain, right? The positive things, the negative things, and the Kohanim in the middle, and that represented the total Achdus of Klal Yisrael, what's it called, in accepting the Torah. The positive and the negative. On the other hand, on the Choshen, which is the Nodim L'Chaveiro, how we function between man and man, there every Shevet had their own stone. Not that six Shvatim were written on one stone and six on the other. Why? Because when it comes to Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, every person is an individual. Everybody's different. Every Shevet's an individual to himself. There, the Achdus is not total, what's it called, conformity. There, there's individuality also. Everybody has their own individual stone with its own color or whatever. And the Achdus is that they're all within the same Misgeret. They're all on the Choshen, but they're all different. So when it comes to Beinor Lechaveiro, everybody's different. But we're united in one framework. When it comes to Beinor Lamachom, we're all united and the same. We have all the same Amunah, whatever, that's it. One more thing, and then we'll let you go. It says the Kruvim, that's where God's presence was in the Mishkan. Mibein Shnei HaKruvim. There's a Gemara, the Gemara says, Mokav Rav Shekoro Har. The Mikdash is not referred to Har HaKodesh, Har Hashem Nirah, like Avraham Avinu called it. V'lo ki Yitzvah Shekoro Sodeh, V'yetze Yitzvah Vasuach Vasodeh, Ela ki Yaakov Shekoro Bayis. He's thinking that there are different ways that people relate to God. And they're all true, but they're different aspects. There's how I relate to God as an individual, okay? As a mamish individual myself, that was represented by Avraham Avinu. He came to his belief in God as an individual. Echad hoya Avraham. Before he had a wife, before he had children, as an individual, 2-3 years old, Ikiris Bolim. He had that personal relationship with God. That's what he saw, the Ikar of the Mikdash, that personal relation, like a mountain. You go up isolated on a mountain and you commune with God, like going up to the Guru of the Havdal El Havdal, you know, sitting alone at the top of the mountain, communing with God. That's one aspect of the Mikdash. Then there's another aspect, as a couple. Yitzchak Avinu perceived the Mikdash as a place that's a husband and wife. That's when he perceived the Mikdash, when he died, when he got a shidduch. So people relate to God as part of a couple. That's another way of relating to God. That's a sodah. The Gemara says in Ksubas that a woman is called the sodah of the husband. Shvei habal. Nistapcha sodeh. So the sodah relationship is husband-wife relationship. We learn Kedushin from Shvei Ephraim. So that's another second idea. And Yaakov Avinu represents the third idea. He saw the Beis HaMikdash as a bayis. He was on his way to build Beis Yisrael, a family. An individual, a couple, and a whole family. Children, parents, whatever, each one interacting together. So we don't call the Mikdash the Har, the individual, nor the Sodeh, but the Ikar is the bayis. The entire gamut of relationships in a family is how we relate to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Sometimes we relate to them as children, sometimes as parents, and that's the Kruvim. Think about it. Where is God's presence in the Mikdash? In the Kruvim. The Kruvim, it says, represented one of three things. Either one was male and one was female, representing God's connection to the Jewish people. If that's the case, then one of them represented the Jewish people. That's the individual. God relates to every individual Jew. One of the Kruvim represented the Jewish people. Another opinion says that the Kruvim represent husband and wife. And ish v'ish, shechina shruya b'neihem. So one was male, one was female, one was a husband, one was a wife. It's a second relationship, a couple. And another opinion says that the Kruvim represent the children. They have the faces of children. So you have all three relationships. You have the relationship as an individual, you have the relationship as a couple, and the relationship of children of the family. So in those Kruvim were all these three relationships. In addition, this Gemara that says Har, Sada, Bayis has another meaning. The Rambam says the Mikdash had three functions. It should be a house of God, a place where you feel God's presence, where you can come to recognize God, like we said, and to there the Jewish people unite and ascend three times a year, Shalosh Regalim, Aliyah L'Regel, and there you make sacrifices. Think about it, those three functions are these three functions. The mountain is where you ascend three times a year. The field is the concept of fertility, of prayer. Vayetze Yitzhak Asur Vasoda, sacrifices. You use it as a fertile place to create the various effects. And the bayis is bayis Lashem. That is the main thing, that it's a place where you can feel God's presence. So the three functions that the Rambam says are reflected in this Gemara of Har, Sodeh, and Bayis.